This is Tax Update for Saturday, March 3rd, 2006. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the documents supporting the podcast may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast itself. And such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. Tax Update Podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as an access to a library of useful tax information those of us in tax practice can take advantage of. If you wish to subscribe, please visit them on their website at www.limeburgservices.com. Well, we're into now March, and tax season is fully underway. And we came across an issue on the California discussion group that I thought needed to be explored a little bit more, at least discussed a little more openly. And as you may realize, especially those of you following along on the California group who are picking up on this podcast here in March, I tend to do these podcasts slightly in advance of the date when they're going to be posted, just to keep on schedule, especially during tax season. So this is a discussion that will have taken place. Actually, it would be back a little over a week, 2 weeks earlier. But what we're going to discuss here is an issue that has arisen in a number of cases, and not just on that group, but on other groups, about the use of the disclaimers regarding Circular 230. And the issues becoming when they are used, how they are being used, and perhaps how they're being overused and abused in these cases. Now, some of this reminds me of an old Star Trek episode. You may remember years ago there was a Star Trek episode, the old Star Trek show. And for those of you of a certain age, no, we're not talking about the one with Jean-Luc Picard. We're talking about the one prior to that. Yes, the old one. Where there was this episode called The Trouble with Tribbles. Well, now we're going to talk about The Trouble with Disclaimers. Like Tribbles, these disclaimers initially appear to be kind of non-offensive, simple, it's an easy solution to a problem. We just plaster them on everything. And I'm sure we've all seen disclaimers come out to us on some of the most innocuous emails and letters you can imagine, confirming things like luncheon appointments, telling us that we can't rely on the confirmation of the luncheon appointment in escaping penalties under Circular 230. Well, as we've discussed earlier in this podcast, we discussed earlier on in an earlier episode the issues of the rules under Circular 230 and the issues involving covered opinions. And what the disclaimer has become an effort on the behalf of many firms and many individuals to essentially deal with Circular 230 with a blanket approach. The problem is the blanket both covers up more than it has to, and the blanket fails to cover situations where you still need a Circular 230 covered opinion. And because of that, I think the profession's reliance on this disclaimer, and by the profession, I do mean attorneys, accountants, and EAs, because I believe all of us have been involved in the overuse of this disclaimer, we have basically caused some major problems both for our clients and for ourselves because of having made use of these disclaimers in cases where they just don't work. Now, practical answer, there is a place where you need a Circular 230 disclaimer. The Circular 230 disclaimer, though, only really applies to a subset of the covered opinion rules. That is, where we find the disclaimer language that tends to be used almost exclusively is on the issue of a reliance opinion. Now, a reliance opinion came to a conclusion regarding a significant federal tax matter at a more likely than not level of assurance that basically had a significant purpose of federal tax evasion, or not evasion, but reduction, shall we say, reduction of federal taxes. Note, that was the significant purpose transactions only that fit into this category. However, this has been expanded to try to cover the entire range of issues that deal with the covered opinion, and this is where we get into our problem. Now, in response to a discussion that started on the California board regarding a disclaimer that was posted to an email that was posted in the discussion, I ended up putting up a commentary that kind of summarized the issues. On the California Tax Talk board, there have been long discussions, which I participate in, as has Kip Dellinger, who writes on this topic for CCH, and has have a number of others on that board, on the issues of the Circular 230 disclaimers, how they work, how they don't work, the whole Circular 230 covered opinion scenario. So I went ahead and summarized, because the question became, the email in question said that it was a required disclaimer. Basically, U.S. Treasury required disclaimer, this cannot be used for, you know, escaping penalties. And it was in response to a question on the board. And I posted a response that went through a few points on this as we were discussing back and forth. Now, I start off, and you'll see the actual printed document in my documentation for this week. You'll see the actual printed response. You know, a lot of people, as I note, are using the disclaimer and have used the required word. Well, no question that's technically wrong. Nothing requires you to use a disclaimer. It may be the simplest solution in a case to deal with the issue as opposed to a covered opinion, but obviously you always could do a covered opinion, so required is overstating. However, the term required is often used mainly to avoid the discussion with clients. Let's be honest, it's easier to tell a client that the Department of Treasury requires me to do this than to explain that the Department of Treasury says if I do this and I don't have to do the covered opinion, I don't have to do all these other things, and I've just got to tell you, you can't use this for penalty protection. And if this might be a covered opinion, then I'm out of trouble and I won't get in trouble with the Treasury Department if I include the disclaimer. That's a quick summary of where you really stand. But we went into a little more depth as to what's going on with this. Let's consider the concept of why these disclaimers have been used so broadly. I think there's a couple of reasons in play. One key reason, and why we see the larger firms using them very, very widely, and in fact attaching them everywhere and kicking them in as Outlook signatures that automatically appear on emails. In fact, as I recall, there's even software out there now to automate the whole process to assure an email can't leave your building without the Circular 230 or whatever disclaimer you want on it. But it has been grabbed by them because other provisions that we found when these rules went in made the person in charge of the tax practice essentially personally liable if the firm was operating outside the Circular 230 parameters. Now, that particular provision, to be honest, is scarier the more people you have working in your firm who do tax work. In my firm, there are probably five of us in total who would reasonably ever issue a statement that might, at some way, shape, or form, be considered a covered opinion. However, if you're talking about an international accounting firm, we're talking in the thousands of people who are issuing documents on a daily basis that are going to deal with tax issues and that could conceivably cause us to run into trouble. I have a pretty easy time watching the five to make sure what the five of us are up to and we can watch each other. It would be a lot more difficult for me to watch 5,000 and make sure those 5,000 are doing it. Therefore, the use of the disclaimer was, frankly, and I think those firms understand, an imperfect solution to try at least cover them in some cases. The hitch is that you have to understand, and I pointed this out before, and I apologize in advance for offending anyone in a firm that has this policy, but I think, frankly, you have to state it because you have to understand the reason to do it. What the policy essentially states by requiring everyone to disclaim everything is one of two things. I either believe that individuals who my firm is marketing as being tax experts and giving tax advice simply don't know the rules and can't be trusted to apply federal regulations to a tax matter. They can't apply Circular 230 to figure out when they should disclaim and when they shouldn't, so I'm just forcing them to disclaim all the time. Now, that's a vote of no confidence, shall we say, in those individuals' ability to apply law and regulation to the facts in question. The second way to view that, though, unfortunately, is another one, and that is, I think some of them may know full well how to apply this, but they're going to cut corners and they'll leave it off of statements where it's required simply because they are less honest than I'd like them to be. I mean, I'm holding responsibility for this as head of the tax practice. I don't want them, you know, I would want certain decisions to be made, but some of the other 8,000 might make a different decision, and I might not like that decision, and there's going to be at least some of those 8,000 who will be out there and out there a lot further than I'd want to be. So what we have said by having a firm-wide policy that every email that leaves the building will have a circular 230 disclaimer is essentially to say that I don't trust these people to do this. Now, I'll be honest, if I was in charge of 8,000 people, if I had 8,000 people under, you know, theoretically that I could be claimed to be responsible for supervising the tax practice for, I probably would come to the same conclusion. I don't know that I can deal with 8,000 and reasonably take, you know, reasonably have that level of control. I can be very diligent. I can be very involved. I can certainly try to have the processes in place to make this happen, but I can't be really, really sure there won't be a rogue partner or a rogue office that won't cause me problems. So, makes sense. The problem is that solution, which is imposed by sheer size, to be honest, has been adopted by people who are the only tax professional in the firm in question. In which case, you're now saying you're not sure you can handle the application of the tax law to a situation. That seems a less than thrilling way to present to the client about why they should be paying you for tax advice if you don't even trust your own tax advice enough to accept the consequences. But let's go on and let's ignore that side of the fix, and let's just look at where this falls apart anyway. Let's take the disclaimer on the bulletin board or on the tax talk news group. The problem with that disclaimer is it doesn't seem likely that it's going to be anything, a traditional covered opinion, because we're not talking with the taxpayer about a transaction. The concern on those groups has been more that this might become a marketed opinion. That is, it might be used by somebody to promote a scheme, investment, whatever, and that as a marketed opinion being given out in total, that could cause us a problem. Well, here's our hitch. The disclaimer for marketed opinions is different in a couple of significant ways, I should say. Maybe not very different, that's probably overstating it. But there are a couple of significant points that must be made to have a valid disclaimer on a marketed opinion. The most important of those points to have a disclaimer that's valid under Section 1035B5 of Circular 230 is that your marketed opinion has to admit it would be a marketed opinion. That is, the disclaimer requires you to say you're being used to market a tax program and then advise individuals to seek their own outside opinions from competent outside counsel. Now, I don't know about you, but the last thing I want to do is just blanket claim that every document I'm putting out there is being used to market a tax program. That certainly seems to open me up to liability if that doesn't work, regardless on the penalty side. Yeah, maybe the IRS now can't take me, but certainly those other people can say, this was marketed, you knew it was marketed because you actually said it was going to be used to market this program, and therefore you're now responsible. Nobody's going to attach that to the email unless they actually are planning it to be tied into the marketing of a program. So we don't see that in the blankets, but if that's not there, then it won't work as a marketed opinion disclaimer. The hitch is, as I said, the disclaimer does not work in all cases. Second, the disclaimer is only valid, limited purpose, for a reliance opinion. This, I think, is a major danger that those in large firms face. The big concern I have with the use of disclaimer from this side is, for too many individuals, this was the fix, and it totally fixed, and we could go back and ignore Circular 230 from here forward. We just skipped all these rules on covered opinions because we put a disclaimer in. The disclaimer is not valid if you are using if the opinion is meant to cover a listed transaction or a principal purpose transaction. Now, the paranoia, and I do believe it's paranoia, that the professions got into in planning these disclaimers on everything tells us that we should be consistent, at least if we're going to evaluate the IRS reaction. If we believe they're going to be paranoid to find that everything is a potential reliance opinion, because everything's a significant federal tax issue and everything meets the criteria involved to get us into the reliance opinion arena, then I think you've got to be consistent in your paranoia. And I think in that case, listed transactions and transactions that are principal purpose transactions are a significant problem. Why? Keep your paranoid thinking cap on now, because you've gone the paranoid route by putting the disclaimer on everything. If you keep your paranoia cap running, go to the listed transaction definitions and go to the regulation and look at the definition of substantially similar under the regulations. And what you will find is the IRS there tells you this is a paranoid definition. Substantially similar means, as I've said tongue-in-cheek, somewhat like. So if you have a transaction you comment on that is either a listed transaction clearly in the list or is substantially similar to a listed transaction, meaning somewhat like, you cannot disclaim. If you attempt to disclaim, that's an invalid disclaimer, and I will suggest an invalid disclaimer is worse than no disclaimer. Because not only did you, basically, you disclaimed may have worked against your client's interest, as we'll discuss later, but you gave one that didn't work anyway and that proves primarily you didn't know what you were doing. And that can be used to show malpractice, and malpractice cases are a major problem we may have in this area. So it doesn't work for listed. Secondly, it doesn't work for principal purpose transactions. There's the key difference. If we're going to be paranoid, we have to go that principal purpose, you know, when is the IRS going to view a transaction as principal purpose rather than significant purpose? An example I've given when lecturing on Circular 230 that I would suggest from the IRS's perspective would probably be a principal purpose transaction, at least to many people in the service, is virtually anything regarding a family limited partnership for transfer tax purposes. I'm not saying the IRS has this right, but I am saying their general viewpoint on family limited partnerships is these are being formed solely for tax purposes. There is only a tax purpose. If the IRS seriously believes that, then that seems almost a textbook definition to them of principal purpose transaction, meaning that any disclaimer discussing a transaction involving a family limited partnership would be also invalid. Again, a bad disclaimer is probably worse than none. And in this case, you're in hot water again. The issue, you have to understand that even if you want to keep using disclaimers, and I admit many of you will decide you want to keep using them now, you know, aren't going to change and won't do anything differently, that's fine, but understand they do not work in those cases. If you have a listed transaction, meaning your staff better know what listed transactions are, and they're probably a pretty good reason they should know what they are anyway, you and your staff should keep up on that. But even for this purpose, you need to keep up so you know when you get into those. Or you have to step back and say, would this be deemed a principal purpose transaction? And if so, now my disclaimer is no good. And evaluate that with the same paranoia you're using to decide the IRS is going to see every letter you send out. Because we had people ask the question, seriously, do you put the disclaimer on every single transmittal letter you send out? You know, attached or included is your 1040 for 2005. This cannot be used to get you out of any penalties. basically, if we're going that level of paranoia for that written document that merely said your 1040 is in the envelope, I don't know how relying on that's going to be any sort of reliance issue, but maybe it was. But if we're going that route, at that level of paranoia, then we have to be just as paranoid in evaluating our principal purposes. Finally, a real problem you've got is that these disclaimers are overly broad. The disclaimer language the IRS put in Circular 230 says nothing about the disclaimer only not getting you out of penalties for items where you need a more likely than not opinion. The disclaimers, and the ones I've seen on every email, apply to every penalty, including the penalties that we have that do not require you to have a more likely than not position. What's the ones that don't? Take a look under Section 6662, because there's some very interesting language in here that I think is important and has to be looked at. I think it also helps to understand Circular 230 and where the IRS was coming from. But 6662 generally provides that if you have an understatement, if you've disclosed properly, if we look under, even with a substantial understatement, if it's not related to a tax shelter, if you've disclosed properly and there's a reasonable basis, and we talked about reasonable basis under Circular 230, when we talked about the IRS has to have a reasonable basis to challenge, and we said that's substantially less than 50%, applying the same term here, that means the taxpayer does not need a 50% chance of prevailing for the item that they can get out of the penalty. And that's found under 6662D2B is where you're going to find where you've disclosed an item that you get out of it by just having a reasonable basis. There's all kinds of case law that when we don't deal with substantial understatement, the general penalty rules, we can get out of it by reliance on a professional. That's part of our reasonable basis. However, if that document that we have from the professional, the information we got from the professional was covered by a disclaimer that says you can't use it for getting out of penalties, period, then it would certainly seem, again, let's keep the paranoid IRS theory in our mind because that's where we went to put the disclaimer on to begin with. I don't think you have to be nearly as paranoid to believe the IRS would use that against you and state that you said they couldn't use it for this, so why are you putting this in front of me to show they reasonably relied on a professional? The professional told them they couldn't rely on this. So they should have sought other opinions. You know, the professional was telling them this was an issue that they couldn't rely upon. The professional is conceding it was a significant purpose transaction. And, in fact, kind of interestingly enough, take a look down further in Section 6662. Take a look at C. And note the definition of a tax shelter and follow that back into Circular 230 and the definition of a significant purpose transaction. And what you're going to find in the covered opinion rules is that they almost come verbatim from the wording of this code section. Therefore, I would say it could be argued that by putting the disclaimer in, which says this would be a substantial, this would be a reliance opinion, it'd be a reliance opinion because this is a substantial a significant purpose transaction. If you tell me that's the reason, then I'm saying, well, virtually you've conceded that it's a tax shelter and the special rules involving tax shelters apply to this issue, which means it's tougher to get out of the penalties again. We're back to now we do need basically a better than 50% chance. The more likely than not test comes into play. And we have now just moved our taxpayers to the more likely than not test, and we've told the taxpayer we didn't give them a more likely than not opinion that they could rely upon for this purpose. This opens up a hornet's nest of liability issues for the professional. Because previously the taxpayer may have reasonably relied on the professional, and maybe the professional even reasonably did their work, they just happened to be wrong, or they made a reasonable error. The whole penalty could go away. Now, the client couldn't rely on that statement. The professional told him he wasn't doing the work to make this reliable. Now, the penalty's there. The client's still going to look back to the professional to pay the penalty. And quite honestly, a state court may very well still require the preparer to pay the penalty or basically recompensate the client for the penalty because most times, I suspect, most of us are not getting our clients to sign off on or agree that they don't want a covered opinion, that instead they'll take this. I mean, if we put a disclaimer on every email, I doubt that for every email we've got an engagement letter that comes out and says, oh yeah, you've made the decision that you don't want to pay for a covered opinion on this answer, so it's okay for me to use a disclaimer. I think there are some major, major problems there. Now, I note in my response, because we had discussions and Kip Dellinger has noted numerous times in discussions on the California Society's board, that he's had discussions with those at the upper level of the Office of Professional Responsibility at the IRS, and their position is that they feel the profession has grossly overreacted. This is not what they're aiming for. They did mean by 6662, borrowing the language from the tax shelter there, to deal with basically the same things that that penalty provision dealt with. And that's where they were going. That's why they used that language. So I think we have probably overreacted in the place. And I think you need to seriously consider as well. Please make sure, even if you believe paranoia is proper, and I've got to disclaim I have no options, make sure that you and your staff understands that even if we're going the paranoid route, there are going to be cases, therefore, that need to be flagged. Finally, maybe you're one of those who've decided you never need to worry about this. Total ignorance is great. I'm just ignoring it entirely. That's not a good position either. I don't believe the Circular 230 rules are such in the covered opinion area that a reasonably, shall we say, active or involved tax practice is not going to hit cases where those rules would come into play, and you are going to need to have the talk with your client about the fact that I'm going to need to disclaim on this, or I'm going to need to do something else, or you're going to need to pay for a covered opinion, and that's going to be messy, and I may very well tell you to go somewhere else to get that done because I don't do them to that extent. But those will arise and come up, and those you need to have the discussion. I suspect that if you've decided it never will happen, that's wrong as well. It will happen. You will have those discussions. But it also is not something that happens with every piece of written correspondence that goes out of your office. This has been the tax update for Saturday, March the 3rd, 2006. Hopefully you've had so far an enjoyable and good tax season, and know, as those of us who do a lot of compliance work know, the worst is yet to come for this period, so I'm sure, but it'll be busy. We're now into corporate extension time coming up. It's going to be corporate finished by the 15th of March or extend like mad, so you know a number of you will be getting your corporate extensions ready to go here very shortly. We will hopefully be back next week to talk with you on another tax topic of whatever has developed. This tax update is sponsored by Lineberg Services on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. As well, make sure you do check on your own any of these resources or issues we bring up on this podcast. Check and do your own research before going forward with any position stated on this podcast. Finally, I'd like to suggest that there are some other interesting things you need to be keeping your eye on, and we've talked about and I've suggested in the past, I'm going to remind you now that, you know, computer security is still a major issue and a major problem, becoming more interesting by the day. I do strongly recommend, if you're looking for another podcast, that you take a look at Steve Gibson's Security Now podcast that is found via his, that he puts on with Leo Laporte, that's on, that you can find the basic links to subscribe either in iTunes or at twit.tv, twit.tv. He has a very good background, I think, for security that somebody in your firm needs to be aware of and responsible for, since we're all responsible for the confidentiality of our clients' information and helping to ensure it maintains, it continues to be at least reasonably confidential. Other interesting issue that came up on the discussion groups a little while back is, and it's a position I've taken for years, be very careful about sending out any editable document as an email attachment. My gut reaction, you should never, under any circumstances, use the file send function in your word processor, especially not if that word processor is Microsoft Word. Why? It's amazing the extra information you transmit in a Word file beyond what you can see. Even more important, and that extra information can be names of other taxpayers, names of other clients, can be revisions in the document. I think almost everyone, there's a lot of stories that attorneys and others can give about getting a contract where the revisions were sitting there. In fact, in one case, I remember talking to an attorney, said not only were the revisions there, but the changes were turned on to show by default. So as soon as he opened it up, he saw what the previous person had gotten. You know, they'd been negotiating with somebody else what terms another individual had gotten from this company, and you know what they had started with the offer they were giving his client, but they had eventually given a much better deal at the end. You know, those are not good things to be telling people. Watch out for that. It does go along with those files. If the file does not need to be edited, it should always be sent in a locked down format, non-editable format. PDF is useful. It's not perfect, but it doesn't send along all the details that doc files send along or XLS files will send along. One interesting aside I did, I loaded up a file. So I have a couple machines that don't have Word loaded, but that I have OpenOffice loaded upon, which will open and save Word files. That's fine. I have noticed, though, that if I take a Word file, open it in OpenOffice and immediately save it back out, that in many cases, the size of the file drops by half with all the details being there. I can open it back up in Word. Everything looks perfect. What that tells you is there is a lot of information that went along with that file that didn't need to be there for Word to display it perfectly. Why, in many cases, fast saves, change tracking, all those things go into the document, which a third-party program may very well strip out when it does the saves, especially the fast save option. But be very, very careful in this regard. So again, until next week, this has been Tax Update for March 3rd, 2006.